It should be.
Moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto Jeremiah the second time, while he was yet shut up in the court of the prison, saying, Thus saith Yahweh, the maker thereof, the Lord that formed it to establish it, Yahweh is his name. Call unto me, and I will answer thee, and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not. For thus saith Yahweh, the God of Israel, concerning the houses of this city, and concerning the houses of the kings of Judah, which are thrown down by the mounts and by the sword. They come to fight with the Chaldeans, but it is to fill them with the dead bodies of men, whom I have slain in my anger and in my fury, and for all whose wickedness I have hid my face from this city. Behold, I will bring it and cure. I will bring it health and cure, and I will cure them, and will reveal unto them the abundance of peace and truth. And I will cause the captivity of Judah and the captivity of Israel to return, and will build them as at the first. And I will cleanse them from all their iniquity, whereby they have sinned against me, and I will pardon all their iniquities, whereby they have sinned, and whereby they have transgressed against me. And it shall be to me a name of joy, a praise, and an honor before all the nations of the earth, which shall hear all the good that I do unto them. And they shall fear and tremble for all the goodness and for all the prosperity that I procure unto it. Thus saith Yahweh, again there shall be heard in this place, which ye say shall be desolate without man and without beast, even in the cities of Judah, and in the streets of Jerusalem, that are desolate without man and without inhabitant and without beast. The voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the voice of them that shall say, Praise Yahweh of hosts, for Yahweh is good, for his mercy endureth forever, and of them that shall bring the sacrifice of praise into the house of Yahweh. For I will cause to return the captivity of the land as at the first, saith Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, again in this place, which is desolate, without man and without beast, and in all the cities thereof shall be an habitation of shepherds, causing their flocks to lie down.
User entered your channel.
In the cities of the mountains, in the cities of the vale, in the cities of the south, and in the land of Benjamin, and in the places about Jerusalem, and in the cities of Judah, shall the flocks pass again under the hands of him that telleth them, saith Yahweh. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will perform the good thing which I have promised unto the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. In those days and at that time,
okay, Joe, slow down. I don't know if you want to discuss any of this before we get too much under the bridge and we lose it all. I don't remember too much about last week, to be honest with you, about speaking about Jeremiah being in prison. They wanted to put him in prison in chapter 29. And evidently, when the king of Babylon besieged Jerusalem, they put him in prison in chapter 32. That there were probably a few things here to discuss that we could discuss before we rush through it. Evidently, this is the first time that Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. This is when he took the 10,000 princes, the 10,000 principal men of Judah hostage and brought them back to Babylon. And the carpenters and the smiths and all those people, and Daniel and Ezekiel were among those people. And he made Zedekiah the king. And Zedekiah ended up being the last king instead of Jeconiah. And Zedekiah ended up being the last king of Jerusalem. And I think he ruled like 11 years or 12 years before Nebuchadnezzar came back and destroyed it and destroyed the city. So I don't know if y'all need that background history, if we discussed that last week. I really don't remember last week. I'm lucky I remember yesterday right now.
I don't remember last week.
You weren't here. Activated.
No, he was
I
here.
I was.
He was.
Were you here last week? Okay, I'm sorry.
I don't think we discussed that, Bill. If you, even if we did, why don't, you know?
Are you sure we did chapter 32?
Yeah, we did.
We talked about Jeremiah buying the field.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we did. I remember that. I remember that for sure.
Okay, we did.
Microphone muted.
I don't. Yeah, you know, when people read too much at one time, a lot of this stuff slips under the It flows by, and we don't get this to discuss it all. That's all I'm saying.
Microphone.
Half the chapter is good, or 10 or 12 verses, depending on how long the chapter is good. Because I don't want to miss anything without discussing it. But sometimes we just do, and sometimes I'm just tired, right? I slept until 8 o'clock this morning, though, so I'm feeling good.
Yeah, same.
Joe, a lot of times I'm up 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. My eyes can't shut, and I end up getting out of bed and just sitting here and reading. Which is probably good for me, but
usually if I wake too early, after an hour, I can get back to sleep.
I've done that too, yeah, on occasion, but I don't like to, because then by the time I get back up, it's 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, and half my morning's gone.
Yep.
Well,
or you end up waking up every hour.
In this very verse, it says, all their iniquities, whereby they have sinned. So he doesn't offer any condition, any sin.
None whatsoever.
And the captivity will...
I've often cited this in my papers, in my All Israel is Saved arguments. What, where is this promise? If any Israelite is thrown in the lake of fire, what's up with this promise? Why don't the NATOs of the world believe this?
Well, I made a comment in the chat today that NATO may be a grievous wolf, because in Paul says something like, grievous wolves came in and spared not the flock. And that's basically their whole salvation so-called doctrine, you know, is not sparing the flock.
Right. But, you know, you really got to be a self-righteous asshole to look at your own brethren and imagine them to be going to the lake of fire, because they may have done something worse than something you ever did. That's just really being a self-righteous asshole. That's the only way I could describe that. But this isn't the only scripture that says this. There's several of them.
User,
I will cleanse them from all their iniquity.
I will no longer remember the impiety of Jacob.
Your channel.
Yeah, there's a lot of passages like that, promises like that in the Old Testament. I haven't collected them all, but I shouldn't have to collect them all. Two or three should be enough. Two or three witnesses, that should be enough. And I've done that plenty of times. And I still get flack a lot of people in CI don't like the things I do at Christogenia, and this is one of the things. This is one of their biggest, most common problems, is that they don't believe that all of the seed of Israel shall be saved. They just don't believe it. They're going to think of some white guy that's such a douchebag, he needs to go into the lake of fire with all the Jews and the niggers. And then they'll figure out, once you do that, then you can get some magic Jews and magic niggers to put in the kingdom of heaven. Because they were good.
They never would have done those things if they weren't around all that corruption. Probably that's why. Hey?
Yeah, right. I mean, when a man sins, it's none of us like it. I mean, we all want to beat his ass or whatever. But you don't know what experience in his life that led him to do that. You don't know.
It's like all of us growing up with these so-called friends, right? They were all bastards. They were the ones who showed us all bad things, like drugs and what, you know what I mean, other bad things too.
It's like the author of sin versus like people who are tempted into sin by the authors of sin,
right?
You know, that's the difference. I like this verse 3 as well. Call unto me and I will answer thee and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not. You know, that sounds like prophecies in Isaiah, like come, bring forth your strong reasons. Isn't it I, Yahweh, who have announced these things? But, you know, he says, he's basically saying his prophecies come true and he's showed these things that he is God.
Yeah. Yeah, it's in Isaiah chapter 44, 45. People don't realize, and I talked about it, I think, in my last Revelation program, when Isaiah prophesied about the fall of Babylon, that was even before Babylon was an empire. I think it was Micah that talked about the same thing, basically. I'm saying the people that were alive in the 7th century, at the end of the 7th century when Babylon became an empire, that they should have realized the importance of Isaiah's words, because they had them, at least a number of them had them, and perhaps that's why we have Isaiah today, right? Because those people did realize the importance of his words, because those things were fulfilled in their lifetimes, and they knew that Isaiah lived 100 years before that.
They would have said, like, Yahweh is true, just like today. We should see the enemies surrounding Israel, and we should say, oh, Christ was speaking the truth.
Exactly. We should. Revelation chapter 20, we certainly should.
Instead, they all lament the punishments.
They all want to fix the punishments for themselves. They all want to have a better idea. That they don't even think they should be punished.
That God made us and he has the right to judge us and punish us. And he's like the author of our lives. But they think they're apart from God somehow. Like they don't have, he has no right to expect anything of them.
They just don't take God seriously.
You see this verse 11 where it says, the voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride. I think earlier in Jeremiah, he says he'll take away the joy of the bridegroom and the joy of the bride. Because when people get married, they used to like rejoice in victory, you know, I guess. And God took that away, and now he's saying that it'll come back.
Yes, it's in Jeremiah 7, 16, 25, that it's going to be gone. It's going to be taken from Jerusalem, warning after warning. But this is also in the Revelation, in chapter 18, about the fall of Babylon. It's the same thing. Revelation 18:23, speaking about Babylon, and the light of the candle shall shine no more at all in thee, and the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. It's basically the same language, which I didn't bother to cross-reference Jeremiah, but I was cognizant of that when I did my commentary. I just thought that other aspects of it were more important. Yeah, it's hard to comment on every aspect in any single commentary because you'll like never stop writing.
Yeah, it's the word of God, so we can barely even comprehend it when he's talking to us, I guess.
Well, it's difficult sometimes.
I suppose God sort of lowers himself to man so that man might understand him.
Yeah, so I say that all the time.
Yeah, well, I read a lot of your work. I've probably got similar ideas.
Probably rubbed off.
God's being on man's terms that very often man can't understand. And he speaks to us on his own terms, on our own terms. I mean, the prophet Jonah going to Nineveh is an example of that. God speaking to man on his own, on men's terms and not on his terms.
Or the guy seeing the owl and then dying later.
Yeah, right. And I've mentioned that, right, exactly. Herod, yeah, you know, Josephus, in the Bible it says Herod Agrippa II saw it, Herod Agrippa I, I'm sorry, saw an angel and fell dead. And in Josephus, he saw an owl and fell dead. Well, Clifton thought the angel turned himself into an owl. But I think that Yahweh used an owl as a messenger to send him a message. And my viewpoint of it is much more practical than Clifton's. But he stuck by his guns. That's all right. Yahweh could use an ant or a roach as a messenger if he wanted to send you a message. I mean, it doesn't have to be a heavenly angel. But in that instance, that owl was an angel. Because that's Herod's pagan terms. Herod Agrippa believed in all that paganism of sights and apparitions and the motions of birds that the ancient Greek augurs believed in. That it was the same sort of paganism. If a bird flew from the left or from the right, it was seen as a good omen or a bad omen. And in fact, in Greek, the word for left actually means good omen. The Greek word for right is dexius, and the Greek word for left, I believe, is eunomia or eunomus or something like that. Let me see. Oh, yes, eunomus is the Greek word for left. And it means good omen, or to be of good name, prosperous, fortunate. So that's the Greek word for left. It's because that was what their augurs believed of the flight of birds, that if you needed an omen and looked up at the sky, if you saw a bird coming from the left, it was a good omen. Coming from the right, it was a bad omen, or vice versa. Maybe it was flying to the left or flying to the right. I really don't remember. But it's all over Homer. It's all over the epic poets. Homer, Hesiod, it's in there many times.
Herodotus mentioned it too.
There you go. So Herod saw this owl. And to see an owl in the daytime is an oddity, because they're very nocturnal. They're not generally out in the daytime at all. And he saw this owl and he took it as a bad omen and he fell down. That's when he died. He knew he was going to die as soon as he saw the owl. And he was dead a few days later. So yeah, God speaks to men on their own terms. And that's why Jonah was swallowed by a whale. And that's why his name was Jonah, because the Assyrians would understand the dove and the fish in the light of their own religion about Semiramis, or the idol that the Greeks called Semiramis, and their own religion. On their terms, they would have understood the symbolism of the dove and the fish. And that's why they listened to Jonah. And God speaks to men on their own terms. It's over and over again in scripture. And some people don't get that. Well, we can finish the chapter 33, I guess.
All right. Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will perform a good thing which I have promised unto the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. In those days and at that time will I cause the branch of righteousness to grow up unto David, and he shall execute judgment and righteousness in the land. In those days shall Judah be saved, and Jerusalem shall dwell safely, and this is the name wherewith shall be called the Lord our righteousness. For thus saith Yahweh, David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel. Neither shall the priest, the Levites, want a man before me to offer burnt offerings and to kindle meat offerings and to sacrifice continually. And the word of Yahweh came unto Jeremiah, saying, Thus saith Yahweh, if ye can break my covenant of the day and my covenant of the night, and that there shall be not, and that there should not be day and night in their season, then may also my covenant be broken with David my servant, that he should not have a son to reign upon his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. As the host of heaven cannot be numbered, neither the sand of the sea be measured, so will I multiply the seed of David my servant and the Levites that minister unto me. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah saying, considered thou not what this people have spoken, saying, the two families which Yahweh hath chosen, he hath even cast them off? Thus they have despised my people, that they should be no more a nation before them. Thus saith Yahweh, if my covenant be not with day and night, and if I have not appointed the ordinances of heaven and earth, then will I cast away the seed of Jacob and David my servant, so that I will not take any of his seed to be rulers over the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For I will cause their captivity to return and have mercy on them.
All the promises are for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, period, and for nobody else. I don't know how the fucking Roman Catholics twist this, but they do. They just ignore this and twist the New Testament.
It's all spiritual.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's literally what I'm told every time.
Now, a lot of people, and Cliff and I both use this verse a lot to address the people that claim that Judah was never divorced. There were actually people claiming an identity that were not two seed liners. They were mostly British Israel people claiming Judah was never divorced. And here the two families can only be Israel and Judah, and it's mentioned explicitly that they're Israel and Judah. The two families which Yahweh has chosen, he has even cast them off. And they'll claim Judah was never divorced, but I think it's Ezekiel chapter 23. When we do Ezekiel, when we go through Ezekiel in a month or two from now, we'll see the chapter where Yahweh divorced Judah. He just didn't use the word explicitly. He didn't use the word divorce explicitly. But here, Israel and Judah, both families are cast off. They're both divorced. Even if those people that returned built the second temple, that second temple never had in it the Ark of the Covenant. And if you read the law and what it takes to propitiate sin, it requires the Ark of the Covenant, or there is no propitiation for sin. If you don't pour the blood on a mercy seat, there's no propitiation for sin in the law, period. And if there's no Ark of the Covenant, there's no mercy seat. So even though those Second Temple people were going through the motions, they didn't have any propitiation for sin until Christ, period.
And who would you say are what this people have spoken? So who are this people? Are they the enemies of Israel, or are they Israel? That verse 24, considerest thou
this is a rhetorical statement, and the words are being planted in the mouth of the enemies of Israel. And that's that they should be no more a nation before them, meaning the Israelites should be no more a nation before the heathen nations, right? So yeah, that's a rhetorical argument being placed into the mouth of the enemies, but it's making an example to us. Even if the enemies don't understand who they're exterminating, they're trying to exterminate the Israel of Yahweh. Now, the enemies don't understand it that way, but that's how Yahweh understands it. So he's planting, using the prophet to plant those words in the mouth of his enemies as a rhetorical argument. It's rhetorical.
Yeah, because it's the word of Yahweh. Moreover, the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah.
Right.
And then here at 26, you have, you can see that the line of David is by seed, and that they're ruling over the seed of Abraham. It doesn't say that the seed of David will rule over all the world or anything other than the seed of Abraham here.
Right. All of the universalist arguments are ridiculous in the context of the entire Bible. They all are absurd.
Microphone
activated. They are actually trying to break the covenant with day and night.
Right.
So they're basically denying God. They're denying that Yahweh is God, because God, Yahweh says, I have the covenant with day and night. I am God. And, you know, so my promises come true. And they're saying, well, you're not God, because he's, you know, that's basically what they're doing.
Yeah, it is. And do you know how much audacity that takes? Do you know how, like, wow, how rebellious that is, that thought is? That you could tell God what he meant and correct God? That's the same approach that the rabbis in the Talmud have. So the Roman Catholics and the Universalists are no better than the rabbis in the Talmud.
And it makes sense that they would be like that, the Catholic Church and all the churches, because they're basically influenced by them. It's sort of the way the Jews created Islam. They really created churchianity.
Yeah, they created Roman Catholicism.
Yeah.
And with the replacement theology that Judeans started teaching, and that can be traced back to Judea simply through Justin Martyr. He's the first one that mentioned replacement theology. It's right in the Apology of Justin. And it's explicitly in there. They took it for granted that the Jews were Israel. They didn't know that they themselves were Israel. And they simply imagined that Yahweh must have replaced Israel with the church. Replacement theology. And Justin Martyr expresses it very much on those terms. I mean, I have the passages somewhere, Chris Degani. I can't possibly remember where everything is.
Hey, Bill, do you want to mention about verse 21? Especially since, you know, the whole royal thing this week, whatever it was.
Yeah, is Charles the man who will sit upon the throne? Is that Charles, Bill?
I don't think so. Christ is king now, and he's alive.
Well, no, what I meant was, like, if you look at all the royal families of Europe.
Right.
No, I mean, there's a couple of, like, you know, Sweden, he's still around, and Monaco, and they're all just figureheads. So how do we reconcile verse 21 with our modern world?
Well, because Christ is sitting upon the throne of David first, and there probably are some true descendants of David ruling somewhere in the earth in diverse places, but a lot of these European nobles are bastards now, and right in, let me see where it is. I think it's in Isaiah. Wow. I'm talking about the key of David. Isaiah chapter 22, verse 22. How could I friggin' forget that? 22:22. And the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulders, so he shall open and none shall shut. He shall shut and none shall open. Well, that's nice, but then there's a prophecy that the key of David is fallen.
Yep.
Right? And I'd have to find that. But in Revelation chapter 3, verse 7, and to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that has the key of David. So who has the key of David that fell?
Right, okay.
Christ has it. Christ is saying he has it.
One other thing. The part with the Levites, how do we consider that, the second part of verse 21?
I'm trying to see where the prophecy that the key of David has fallen, and I can't quite put my finger on it. Fasten him to a nail on his glorious house. And that day, Okay, it's right there in verse 25. In that day, the key of David is fastened in the house to a nail. And in verse 25, in that day, saith Yahweh of hosts, shall the nail that is fastened in the sure place be removed and be cut down and fall. So that's the falling of the key of David, right? And Christ has it in Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. And that's the church, that's the church of Philadelphia. So we should know that that key of David has to relate with brotherly love, but it's the brotherly love of a ruler, in my opinion. I don't know if I expressed that in my commentary. I probably didn't. I don't remember, but that's okay. I can't talk about every aspect of scripture in every commentary. It's just not possible. Verse 21 in Jeremiah. I'm sorry, we're at Jeremiah 33:21.
Yeah.
I'm bouncing around in Bible work, so I got to get back to where I was instead of using another tab. No, I did use another tab, dummy. Okay, I'm there. I did use another tab. Okay. Then my covenant. Well, basically, if we have day and night, then the covenant with David will be broken. But we still have day and night, so the covenant with David isn't broken.
And right. The covenant with the Levites, though, because they always have a priest. So I guess Christ is that priest, too.
Okay.
Well, you know, we're all priests in our own right. That there's probably Levites today that are serving us in capacities that we don't even know, man.
Yeah. Okay, but it could just
they don't have to be ministers or pastors. They can be town clerks. The Levites were the town clerks and mayors of the ancient world, right?
But it also could refer to all Christians, right? All Christian men, because we are all priests, right? So I'm just saying it's maybe Levites is being used as a type for the Christian.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure that there were many Levites operating in public capacities all throughout history that we don't even know they're Levites, but Yahweh knows they're Levites. Look at, I'm convinced that Matthew was a Levite because he was a publican. And his father happened to be named Levi. I wonder why.
Yeah, and that was part of their job, right?
Well, that was their ancient job, and since men always followed the vocation of the father, it would have been natural. I'm certain Matthew is called the son of Levi somewhere in scripture. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm probably not wrong. Mark. In Mark, and as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus. Levi, the son of Alphaeus. Wow. I got to consider that one. There's another Mathat, which was the son of Levi in a genealogy in Luke. So Matthew had a... Levi, the son of Alphaeus in Mark chapter 2 must be Matthew. In Matthew chapter 9, because it's the same. It's the same role being fulfilled, and Mark calls him Levi, but Matthew calls him Matthew. Matthew calls himself Matthew. Mark later calls him Matthew. In chapter 3, but in chapter 2 he calls him Levi, the son of Alphaeus. So that's kind of strange. Because later in the scripture, only James is called the son of Alphaeus, but it could be a different Alphaeus. But I always thought Matthew was a Levite. Because of that and because of the role that he fulfilled. He was a publican. If you're a conquering emperor and you conquer another nation, or a conquering entity, I should say, and you conquer another nation and you want to organize it, you're going to naturally use the people that are in those functions already, as long as they're willing to pledge loyalty to you.
Yeah, I think that's how Adamic nations would do it, but Jewish, you know, when you're under the Jews, they just try and invert society completely, and they'll put women and niggers in charge.
Yeah, right, Joe, I knew where you were going with that. You're right about that, because they want to punish the people they conquer, especially white men.
And then you'll have university professors that are retards.
Because they make a mockery of everything they touch, man. They really don't care about it.
And you'll have supermodels with Down syndrome.
Yeah, they've done that too. Or they weigh 400 pounds. And then they call them by euphemisms like plus size. Yeah. They make a perversion of everything they touch. I notice some girls that are heavy, they can't prevent it, and that's okay, but they shouldn't be supermodels, and a good girl would know that, would understand that.
Right.
We shouldn't have supermodels anyway. It's worship of women that we shouldn't have.
Yeah, exactly. I should have added that.
They're always doing that.
I'm going to read chapter 34 then.
Well,
the word which... Oh, did you want to say something, David?
No, I just wonder if Bill's done.
You know, I think so. I think we've treated just about everything we should treat. But the seed is the captivity that's going to return and have mercy, and he's going to have mercy on them. That's the last word in 33. I mean, I don't know how you could buy universalism reading passages like that should make you want to scratch your head.
Seed of David, seed of Abraham, you know.
And not a damn thing about Gentiles. Go ahead, Joe. 22 verses. Try to stop halfway.
All right, then. The word which came unto Jeremiah from Yahweh, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army, and all the kingdoms of the earth, of his dominion, and all the people fought against Jerusalem, and against all the cities thereof, saying, Thus saith Yahweh, the God of Israel, Go and speak to Zedekiah, king of Judah, and tell him, Thus saith Yahweh, Behold, I will give this city into the hand of the king of Babylon, and shall burn it with fire. And thou shalt not escape out of his hand, but shall surely be taken and delivered into his hand. And thine eye shall behold the eyes of the king of Babylon, and he shall speak with thee mouth to mouth, and that thou shalt go to Babylon. Yet hear the word of Yahweh, O Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus saith Yahweh of thee, Thou shalt not die by the sword, but thou shalt die in peace and with the burnings of thy fathers, the former kings which were before thee. So shall they burn odors for thee, and they will lament thee, saying, Our Lord, for I have pronounced the word, saith Yahweh. Then Jeremiah the prophet spake all these words unto Zedekiah, king of Judah, in Jerusalem, when the king of Babylon's army fought against Jerusalem and against all the cities of Judah. Is that a pig? And against all the cities of Judah that were left, against Lachish and against Azekah, For these defense cities remained of the cities of Judah. This is the word that came unto Jeremiah from Yahweh. After that, the king of Zedekiah had made a covenant with all the people which were at Jerusalem to proclaim liberty unto them, that every man should let his manservant and every man his maidservant, being an Hebrew or an Hebrewess, go free, that none shall serve himself of them, to wit, of a Judean his brother. Now when all the princes and all the people which had entered into the covenant heard that everyone should let his manservant and everyone his maidservant go free, that none should serve themselves of them any more, then they obeyed and let them go. But afterward they turned and caused the servants and the handmaids whom they had let go free to return, and brought them into subjection for servants and for handmaids. Therefore the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah from Yahweh, saying, Thus saith Yahweh, the God of Israel, I made a covenant with your fathers in the day that I brought them forth.
You want to stop there, though, right, Joe?
Yeah. I think we'll pick it back up at verse 12 when we take a break here, Joe.
Yeah, that's fine. I thought you said to 22, but that's fine. I'll stop here.
No, I said there were 22 verses, and we should probably stop halfway.
I'm sorry. I have a different way of communicating sometimes. Just a small misunderstanding.
That's okay. It's not the end of the world. We can reread verse 12.
Yeah.
We love you. You're doing a great job reading.
Thank you.
Okay. Here's a problem with the chronological order of the chapters, right? Here, Zedekiah is clearly the king, right? But in verse 37, I'm sorry, in chapter 37, this is chapter 34. In chapter 37, verse 1, we read, And King Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, reigned instead of Kaniah, the son of Jehoiakim. Right there is a problem. Because Zedekiah is the king in 34, but in 37, Zedekiah is just becoming the king, right? Now, Coniah is Jeconiah. Josiah had a son named Jeconiah, who must have been a total scumbag, and he only reigned for about a year. And the Nebuchadnezzar came and removed Jeconiah, or something happened, and Jehoiakim became the king. I don't remember exactly what happened to Jeconiah, but Jehoiakim became the king. Jeconiah only lasted a year. So Jehoiakim's the king, and I think he's the king for like 6 or 7 years. I forget exactly. And the Nebuchadnezzar came and removed Jehoiakim and brought him back in chains to Babylon. Jehoiakim's name is actually in Babylonian inscriptions that were discovered, which verifies scripture. So Jehoiakim goes back to Babylon in chains, and his sons are killed before him, and he had his eyes were put out so he couldn't see, and made Zedekiah the king. Zedekiah was Jeconiah's brother and Jehoiakim's uncle. So that's what's going on here. But the fact is that this verse, that this chapter 34 is out of order with chapter 37, because it must be placed after 37. That there's an order to the chapters in Jeremiah that's correct. I just haven't charted it out yet. Someday I'll chart it out. But these chapters of Jeremiah are not in the correct order. So here in verse 34, in chapter 34, the second clue that this chapter is out of order is the fact that Jeremiah can go and address the king. But in chapter 33 and in chapter 32, Jeremiah was in prison. So now he's evidently not in prison, because he could go address the king. So these chapters are really out of order. But I can't fix it here tonight. I can't fix it during the course of this Bible study. That has to be sat down. I got to sit down and give that a long study. in order to find out which chapter belongs where, which I plan on doing, which I hope to do one day. But it's not going to be today, and it's not going to be tomorrow or next week. Hopefully it'll be sooner or later. That there is a different chapter order in the Septuagint, which I've talked about in these studies. It's very different. I didn't get it out for tonight's study. I might be able to do that if I could find my Septuagint in the dark, because I'm sitting here in a dark room. Nope. I'm failing. I'm sorry. Yeah, I got it. In Brenton's Septuagint, I don't know if y'all got who has a copy of Brenton's Septuagint, but at the very end of the book of Jeremiah, there's a chart that has the order of the chapters, comparing them in the Septuagint order to the King James order. And chapter 34 in the Septuagint is actually chapter 41. Chapter 35 is 42. Chapter 34 in the Septuagint is chapter 27, actually, of what we see in the Hebrew. And it's, there's a couple of missing chunks in the Septuagint. It's really a mess when you compare the two books. And that means that the chapters of Jeremiah were made out of order somehow since perhaps 300 BC, right? 250, 260, 280 BC. They've been out of order after the Septuagint. They were in a different order. So that's all I can say about it for now, but I can't rectify it right now because it would take a lot of study, looking at the context of each chapter and trying to put it in its proper order.
And so here they're promising Yahweh that they'll let their handmaids and their brothers go, but they're going to break that promise.
Yes, absolutely.
Shall I start reading from verse 12?
Yes, sir. That's appropriate, I think, for this chapter.
Therefore, the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah from Yahweh, saying, "Thus saith Yahweh, the God of Israel, I made a covenant with your fathers in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondmen, saying, at the end of 7 years, let ye go every man his brother and Hebrew which hath been sold unto thee, and when he hath served thee 6 years, thou shalt let him go free from thee. But your fathers hearkened not unto me, neither inclined their ear. And ye were now turned and had done right in my sight in proclaiming liberty every man to his neighbor, and ye had made a covenant before me in the house which is called by my name. But ye turned and polluted my name, and caused every man his servant and every man his handmaid, whom ye had set at liberty at their pleasure, to return, and brought them again, and brought them into subjection to be unto you for servants and handmaids. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh, ye have not hearkened unto me in proclaiming liberty. Every one to his brother and every man to his neighbor, behold, I proclaim a liberty for you, saith Yahweh, to the sword, to the pestilence, and to the famine, and I will make you to be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. And I will give the men that have transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant which they had made before me, and they cut the calf in twain and passed between the parts thereof, the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs and the priests and all the people of the land which passed between the parts of the calf. I will even give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of them that seek their life, and their dead bodies shall be for meat unto the fowls of heaven and to the beast of the earth. And Zedekiah, king of Judah, and his princes will I give into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of them that seek their life, and into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which are gone up from you. Behold, I will command, saith Yahweh, and cause them to return to this city, and they shall fight against it and take it and burn it with fire. And I will make the cities of Judah a desolation without an inhabitant.
Well, here, where the covenant is made earlier in the chapter, there's no mention about splitting a calf and passing between the parts. No mention whatsoever. But then when Yahweh explains their failure to keep the covenant, he says that they did that. And what that reveals is that whenever we see men making a covenant in the Old Testament, we should take it for granted that that's how they made it, right? Because that's how covenants were made at that time. And that's how we understand the significance of Yahweh passing between the parts of the animal back in the book of Genesis, when Abraham split the animals in half and Yahweh passed, but Abraham never passed between them, only Yahweh did. And that's why that covenant is unconditional. It don't matter what Abraham does. He has no responsibility whatsoever. Only Yahweh passed through the calf. So only Yahweh has to keep up his end of the bargain. And that's how we know that the Abrahamic covenant is unconditional. Abraham was given no conditions, no responsibility whatsoever to uphold it.
Yahweh can't fail.
Right.
Now, verse 19, it says the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem and the eunuchs. It's got eunuchs here, and that's under the law, they can't have eunuchs.
But the word eunuch in Egypt, in Persia, it ultimately just became a word for anybody that serves the court of a king. Whether they had their testicles or not. It became a general term. Because eunuchs is certainly against the law. But it came to mean just an officer of any court. The term came to be used loosely long after they stopped cutting men's testicles off. They still use the same term. It's the Hebrew word Paris, 5631. It's an official or eunuch. That's in 19. Let me get the Brown Driver Briggs definition. There it is. Oh, that ain't it, dummy. There it is. I'm sorry, I can't find the damn thing. It's got to be that letter. Yeah, I got it. Hakaris. Literally, it means to emasculate. Eunuch being specialized in any meaning, in any case. Okay. That's an inconsequential part of the definition. Eunuch. A military officer. Eunuchs were married. They give examples from Esther. I don't trust Esther, right? That's unfortunate. The title of a high, it was the title of a high military officer, 2 Kings 18, verse 17. Chapter 18, verse 17. The noun meaning court official has its origin in the Akkadian title the one of the king's head, meaning eunuch, arose with the practice of utilizing castrated men in key positions in the various nations of the ancient Near East. The Hebrew word is clearly related to the name of the Akkadian royal official. Accordingly, Saris is not to be translated eunuch unless context or other evidence demands it. Thus, since thorough study fails to uncover conclusive evidence for the employment of eunuchs as officials in ancient Egypt, the reason by which the Egyptian officers in the Joseph narrative were called by this term is probably that in all three cases, these men were special officials of Pharaoh. In other words, they probably weren't physical eunuchs. It can be doubted that Israel would have inaugurated the employment of eunuchs. Such men would have been excluded from the congregation by Mosaic law. It has been argued that they may have been introduced by Jezebel and maintained by subsequent kings in positions in close contact with women. If so, the Lord's promise through Isaiah is most apropos. And that's Isaiah 56:3-5. But of course, that's not true because we're talking about Judah here. We're not talking about Jezebel. And I don't buy that argument.
I can't see chief military men being eunuchs either.
Yeah, they're not. It evolved into a simple term for a court official. Some nations evidently did castrate their court officials, some kings, because if they were going to come in contact with the women in his household, then he wouldn't want any doubt as to who the father of his own children were. So it was apparently used in the ancient world by some men at some times. Was it used by the Hebrews? I seriously doubt it. It's against the law. But the term came to mean a court official or a servant of a king or somebody who is in the court of the king in some appointed capacity or another. And it became a general term for that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that their testicles were removed. And that's against the Hebrew law. They were using eunuchs they were using that term kind of metaphorically just to describe court officers.
Well, I looked up the word for eunuch. It's 5631.
Yeah.
And it actually says court officer, court official.
Yeah, well, that's the definition. I just read a wider definition from Brown Driver Briggs and from the theological workbook by Harris, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was good.
And it also says word origin, probably of foreign origin. So exactly what you're saying is... So it looks like they're just, I mean, the word is just, it never did mean that probably ever in Israel.
No, because it's against the law.
Yeah. So those guys that threw Jezebel out the window were probably, she was probably sleeping with them too.
Right. Yeah, based right. There's no evidence. There's no direct evidence that anybody that practiced the Baal religion had made eunuchs. And the Assyrian religion wasn't plain and simple Baal worship. They had a whole Sumerian pantheon that they inherited. It was much more complicated than that.
Yeah, that's it's pluralized often as Baals. There's so many lords. Some parts of the Bible is
Baal only means lord, right? Baalim is the plural.
Yeah.
And Baalim appears in Hosea. Appears elsewhere.
The Ashtaroth is pluralized sometimes in the Bible. So there were many Ashtaroths.
Well, I just think this is like one more final challenge to make this covenant with Jerusalem, the people of Jerusalem, and they still don't get it. and they still don't obey, even though they made the covenant, they turned their back on it. They didn't free their own brethren from their slavery, from their servitude. So now Yahweh's saying he's going to take Jerusalem, burn it, make it without inhabitant.
Prosperity comes from Yahweh, and people don't have faith in Yahweh, and so they think that they should try and use their brother as a means to become prosperous, which is wrong.
But well, right, absolutely. But aside from that, he keeps on challenging them. Keep your word, do right, obey, keep your word, obey. And they keep failing. I mean, he gives them a lot more than three strikes, right? And you're out. If you go all the way back to Jeremiah chapter 1 and read through, he's probably given them a whole 9 innings full of strikes before he counted them out. I have to take a short break. I'll be back in like a minute, Joe. I'm sorry. Maybe you and David.
That's okay, Bill. Well, I'll ask him when he gets back. But this is that verse in Isaiah, I think it is, where it says that Yahweh delayed punishing Israel probably for like centuries. He would just bear a lot of their sins and delay the punishment. That doesn't mean the law's done away with. That just means that Yahweh delayed the punishments of the law in mercy.
Yeah. Yeah, and even sometimes he would let a king live another 15 years. I can't remember which king that was.
Hezekiah.
It was Hezekiah, yeah.
Hezekiah was crying. And Yahweh's like, okay, go tell Hezekiah he can live.
Yeah.
And he's eating that date cake, and the date cake heals him. I've always wondered about that too, actually.
Actually, I thought it was leaves. They placed leaves on his boils and sores, didn't they? From a date tree?
I'd have to look it up. Bill would know. Well, do you think I should start reading 35? Because Bill probably knows it.
Nah, wait till he comes back. He might still want to say something, right? I don't know.
Yeah, well, with that Unix thing, you know, CFT, we say, you know, there's not going to be any Unix in Israel because it's against the law. But some people, you know, CI Light people will say, oh, no, that just proves that the law can be changed whenever we want.
Well, all they have to do is look up the Strong's definition or a definition like Bill had from the Brown driver brakes, you know? I mean, it's seriously that simple sometimes.
Yeah, it's like Brown driver Briggs agrees with us, and that's an academic source. You know, they recognize that Israel is going to keep their own law, and you can't be a prophet of God if you're like speaking against the law of Yahweh.
It sounds to me like they actually take the English translations and they just don't do any research at all.
Yeah, like surface reading the Bible. Like what it says in English is what it means literally 100%.
Yeah, it's like Star Trek. Everybody in the universe spoke English forever, everywhere.
Yeah, universal translator.
Well, most people don't really know what a word study is. They don't know. And there's times when I was in prison and translating or writing my papers or whatever, things like baptism and what, and broken cisterns or stuff like that, that I would sit or come across an obscure word in Paul of Tarsus. And there's a lot of obscure words in Paul of Tarsus that don't have clean, simple definitions, right? That there's just some compound words and stuff like that that don't have clean, easy definitions that are used in a variety of ways. To sit with a concordance to the Septuagint and look at every single time that word is used in the Greek Septuagint, how it's used, what the context is, in order to figure out how Paul was using it, that takes a lot of time. Study the Liddell and Scott definitions and sit and the Thayer definition, because I had both sources and Strong's, and sit and look at every occurrence where that word occurs in the Septuagint to see if you should agree with those definitions. it takes a lot of work. And sometimes a word study would take me 3-4 hours. But that's what you have to do to build a foundation for yourself in your mind, that you could actually understand some of these words.
Yeah, a good example is in the first chapter of John, Bloods.
Right.
Then you try explain that to people and it's just too much for them. They're just like, nah, I'm bailing. I'm just sticking with the dumb interpretation because I don't want to study all that.
Yeah, right. Much. It's crazy. It is crazy, right, Joe?
Microphone activated.
Yeah, I sat when I translated, when I made my translation of John chapter 1 back in 2006, I got to this word blood and I'm like, what the fuck? It's plural. Why is it plural? So I went and studied. I got the Moulton-Geddon Concordance in the New Testament to see it was plural, to see if it was plural anywhere else in the New Testament. And it actually is in a couple of manuscripts, but not in the oldest manuscripts. So it's really in the New Testament. It's only plural there with any certainty, because there it's plural in every manuscript of the New Testament. So that being said, getting past that stage in the study, going to the Old Testament and studying that word in every occurrence in the Septuagint and seeing that it's almost always where it's plural, it's used of bloodshed, except on one occasion. And I believe that's the way John was using it, is the way that it was used in Hosea, of people of mixed race, mixing bloods with bloods. Yes. So
they have like multiple origins, because blood can mean origin. And so if they've got bloods, it's like saying they have origins, like multiple origins.
Right. And if you have multiple origins, that makes you a bastard.
And mixing blood is kind of a form of bloodshed, really.
Yeah, well, if you're mixing your blood with the bastards, that's death. That's the path of death. Yeah. But most people are just like, oh, Bill, you've gone to, that's just too much for me. I'm just going to go with blood in the cage. It's good enough for me.
I guess it's pitiful.
Microphone muted.
Should I rate 35?
I think it might be getting kind of late. Yeah. Let's hold off on 35 till next week. It's 10 o'clock just about.
Yeah, I got to go to bed.
Yeah, no worries.
And